Good morning and welcome to Talking About California, a series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, California, their home, and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow, I'm your host, I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute. This morning, we'll be talking with the Bay Area writer and healthcare activist, Suzanne Gordon. Good morning, Suzanne. Okay to call you Suzanne?
Oh, please. Absolutely, Cal. It's okay for me to call you Cal.
Sure. Suzanne is a veteran of in the fight for healthcare reform. She's a longtime supporter of a single-payer system, but mostly she's known as a writer and a speaker, in particular as a kind of tribune for nurses. Let me tell you a bit about her resume. It's very long, so I can just give you a couple of highlights. She's written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic Monthly, the American Prospect, the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, and many others. She's also the editor of a series for Cornell University Press called Culture and Politics of Healthcare Work. I think there's something in dispute here about just how many books she's written, but they are many. I have, and I may be underscoring this, 7 books, including Life Support, 3 Nurses on the Front Lines, Nursing Against the Odds, From Silence to Voice, What Nurses Know and Must Communicate to the Public. More, she's written First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Safety. I'm leaving out something there.
Yeah, so some of those books were edited or co-edited. So First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety, I co-edited with someone called Ross Capel. And so it's actually 15 books.
Okay.
But not all of them are about healthcare.
All right.
And the latest one is called Beyond the Checklist, What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Safety and Teamwork. And that was co-written with a pilot, Patrick Mendenhall, and a medical educator, Bonnie Blair O'Connor.
Okay, and just let me finish up. She's a visiting professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, and she's affiliated, an affiliated scholar with the University of Toronto. And finally, if she doesn't mind my saying this, she has 2 daughters. One is a social justice activist in El Salvador, and the other is a student in, guess what, nursing. So, Suzanne, I thought, though, before we turn to nursing, among your 15 books, then I see that the first one was about ballet, the real world of ballet, and the second one I think was called Lonely in America.
Well, yeah, the first one was actually a book called Black Mesa, The Angel of Death, which was a photo essay, and I did the essay part about the Black Mesa strip mine in the strip mine at the Four Corners in the Hopi and Navajo country in Arizona. And then came Lonely in America, and then came Off Balance, the Real World of Ballet.
Okay, so how did you get interested in writing? You're a graduate of Cornell and did graduate work at Johns Hopkins. Was it there? Or how did you become a writer? What took you in that direction?
Well, I'm actually a graduate school dropout. I was getting a PhD in French literature at Johns Hopkins between 1967 and 1969. And I had gone to Cornell as an undergraduate, and I went to Hopkins. I had been very involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and I just realized that being an academic wasn't for me, and I dropped out of graduate school just shy of taking my orals and doing my PhD, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I just didn't have a clue, and I got a job as a secretary in the purchasing department at the Baltimore Sun newspaper. And in those days, you know, the fact that you had almost a master's degree and a woman was going to be a secretary was really not at all, you know, there was no such thing as a woman being overqualified, right? You could have had 12 PhDs and been a secretary. So I got this job at the Baltimore Sun, and I was in the newspaper guild because, you know, anyone who worked there was in the guild. And so I would go to guild meetings with reporters, and I got to know a bunch of reporters, and it had never occurred to me to go into journalism because this was 1969 and 1970, and you know it was before Watergate, which I guess happened a little right in 71 or so. People just didn't think of journalism, at least not where I was. But there I was working in a newspaper, and I thought, wow, you know, I could be a journalist. I was hanging out with a bunch of journalists, and some friends taught me about magazine writing, and I wrote a story for a magazine, or rather I proposed a story for the Sun Sunday magazine. And in those days, you could do things on what's called spec, so it was no cost to them to assign me the story. I did this story on the Greek community in Baltimore. I had a lot of help from my friends editing it, and it was published, and then somebody saw it, and people liked it, and there was a job opening at United Press International, which was a wire service, which doesn't exist now. And, you know, I had contacts, and somebody said, go talk to them, they're hiring, and they have this job opening. And I went over and I talked to them, and my boss, who is a good friend today, who I never let forget this, basically, you know, liked my work and kind of thought I might be good, and basically said to me, this was in 1970, I hired one woman before, she didn't work out, and if you don't work out, I'm never hiring another woman. And I thought to myself, well, if guys don't work out, what do you do, hire dogs, you know? And I got the job, and I worked at UPI for a year and just got this incredibly good training in basic journalism. I never went to journalism school. And, I mean, I'm sort of self-taught and taught by, you know, wonderful mentors. And it was very stressful, but, you know, I got to cover pretty much everything, got to learn how to write really quickly. And that was how I became a journalist.
Okay. And how did you decide to start writing books then?
Well, that's a pretty interesting story. When I was at UPI, I covered George Plimpton, who was doing all these books pretending he was an athlete, and he was with the Baltimore Colts. And I happened to be, the wonderful thing about a very small bureau at UPI was that you got it, there were signs. Stories weren't assigned by seniority. They were assigned by who was at work and who had a car. And I walked into work one day and was told George Plimpton was doing this stint with the Baltimore Colts with the football team, and I sort of said, who's George Plimpton? And or maybe I knew him from the Paris Review, but I knew him literally. And I went out there, and Plimpton was, I went out there to interview him, and he was doing they were doing some very raunchy kind of, the football players, like, show, kind of skit show, and I had to wait for him to interview him till this was over, and they wouldn't let me in because it was too raunchy for a woman on a reporter, and so his PR person who was with him took me out to dinner, and it transpired that his PR person knew Jane Fonda's PR people or had worked for Jane Fonda, and I wanted to write a story about Jane Fonda, a more sympathetic story about her anti-war activism than was currently written. And basically, he helped me get contact with her, and I got this story assignment from this magazine to hang out with her and her anti-war show that she did with Country Joe McDonald and Donald Sutherland at these GI coffee houses off base in the 70s. And I got this assignment, decided to quit UPI, moved to California, and I hung out with her for 2 weeks in Fort Hood in Texas. And book about their going to Southeast Asia. I got a book contract, and then she decided she didn't want me to write a book, but somehow I got into book writing. I mean, I got hooked up with an agent, and I got the concept of book writing hooked up with me, and I started writing books.
Okay.
So I thank you, Jane.
Okay. You might be interested to know that earlier in this series, we interviewed one of the Fort Hood Three. You probably will remember that case, who lives out here on the coast.
Interesting. Yeah. No, I... yeah, I mean, it was very interesting to hang out with them. They were really amazing, and they were very good actors. And, you know, so, I mean, you know, when she said, do you want to write a book about this tour, I said, yes, of course, but how do you get a book contract? How do you get funding? I mean, I'm just this little nobody, and she got me hooked up with this agent who later represented Woodward and Bernstein and so forth. So that was a very lucky and really kind of that was what paved the way for me to write books.
Okay,
which
well,
I really like to do, and I've written a lot.
I see. Well, we have a lot to talk about. So let's move ahead a bit to nursing, which has become your focus
healthcare systems and healthcare reform and patient safety.
Okay. But I read this on your website, which people can see, by the way. It was at www.suzannegordon.com. You wrote this, in 2001, out of a sense of frustration and even outrage at the persistent devaluation of nursing, I sat down to write Just a Nurse. So I wanted to ask you about that and ask you about the frustration involved in your hearing the phrase just a nurse over and over again. Could we talk about that a bit?
Sure. Well, if I could give you a little bit of context. In 1984, I had my first child and in a small community hospital outside of Boston, and I come from a medical family. My father was a famous ophthalmologist and professor at Cornell Medical School, and so I grew up among doctors and really didn't know very much about nurses. And when I had my first baby, my friend was my OB, and I went into the hospital fully imagining that my friend Dolores was going to be there 24 hours or, you know, throughout the whole labor and delivery, and I discovered that she was kind of not there very much. She came in to do some pretty important stuff, but it was the nurses who got me through the labor and who helped me on my road to being a mother and taught me all kinds of things and I needed to know, and also who sorted out all the plumbing problems that happened after I had a baby, which they never tell you about in birthing class. And I realized that there was something wrong with the picture that I had of healthcare and that nurses were really central players and were really important, and I had just, you know, imbibed, as it were, at my father's feet, this image of the doctor knowing everything and doing everything, and also that notion was enhanced and reinforced by the culture of television and the media and so forth. And I left the hospital thinking about nurses and caregiving issues. And then this was in the 80s, the late 80s, when they were having another nursing shortage. And so the media was talking about where all the nurses, they rarely asked nurses why they weren't there so much and why they were leaving their posts or whatever. They were asking docs. And so I began thinking about nursing, and I started writing about nursing, and I got really pulled into healthcare from the vantage point of nurses. And patient care as opposed to medical treatment. And so that set me on this path of writing a lot about nursing and then also moving increasingly into patient safety and teamwork, which we can talk about later. But one of the things that you hear a lot from nurses all the time is, I'm just a nurse, what can I do? I'm just a nurse, no one will listen to me. I mean, I do a lot of lecturing healthcare groups, and I would get a call from a nurse who would say, oh, you know, you're the healthcare expert, I'm just a nurse. And I would go, wait a minute, this is all wrong. I'm a patient. I'm an observer. Yes, I know a lot, but you're the one who's delivering direct care. You know about more than I do, and I got really disgusted with this just a nurse kind of mantra. And I got particularly disgusted when I heard nurse practitioners and so-called advanced practice nurses saying they didn't want anybody to think they were just a nurse. So I think it was the nurse practitioners, the NP, that finally tipped me over the edge. And I sat down and I wrote this thing called Just a Nurse, which some people consider a poem. And I, if you want me to say it, I could do that.
Well, sure, and it's listeners can see it on your website as well, right?
Right, and I'm not going to do the whole thing, but it's basically I'm just a nurse. I just make the difference between life and death. I'm just a nurse. I just make the difference between a patient staying in their own home and going to a nursing home. I'm just a nurse. I just monitor patients undergoing toxic therapies in teaching hospitals and so forth. So it tries to juxtapose this just a nurse notion that's very dismissive with I just do these extremely important things. And I had it made into a poster and a bookmark and so forth because I just got so tired of hearing that just a nurse, because nurses do so many important things, and yet they are have been taught and socialized by the culture to put themselves down.
I saw an interesting slogan on a picket sign in San Francisco not so long ago, the nurses' union, that said, "Save a life, you're a hero. Save 100, you're a nurse."
Oh, that's great. I like that. Yeah. No, and I think that, you know, the reality is that nurses are preventing complications and saving lives every day. And people, they don't talk about their work, and people don't know about their work. And on some level, nurses have to deal in their work with what I call the paradox of prevention, which is that when you prevent something from happening, nothing happens. So you don't see the work they do because nothing has happened. So you think that nothing's happened, but you don't realize that a lot of something had to happen in order for nothing to happen. And what, you know, one of the things nurses do, like in hospitals particularly or everywhere they work, is they prevent worse things from happening. So, and then people think, well, gee, there's no problem, and let's just lay off some nurses.
So does this take us kind of into your book, Nursing Against the Odds?
It does. So the book is called Nursing Against the Odds, How Healthcare Cost-Cutting, Media Stereotypes, and Medical Hubris Undermine Nurses and Patient Care. And I wrote that book because of the crisis in the mid-1990s around managed care and cost-cutting in hospitals, where nurses were, their jobs were being cut. They were being replaced by unlicensed personnel, and you were building this nursing shortage because people learned that there were no jobs in nursing because hospitals and other places weren't hiring, and so basically they didn't go to nursing school, and then enrollments went down, and then pretty soon, you know, if after 4 years you don't have enough people in the pipeline, then you actually get a shortage because then there aren't people who are ready to come through who are ready to go into practice when there are openings. And that's what happened in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so this book, Nursing Against the Odds, was a look at hospital cost cutting, and it was also a look at media stereotypes, where you were looking at how the media culture depicts nursing and how that is a problem because it tells people that nurses are either not very important or they're entirely invisible in medical shows or in movies and so forth or in journalism. And then also there was the problem of medical hubris, medical arrogance, where the physician culture is designed in a way or constructed to really make nursing invisible. And so the book was, it was almost like three books in one, and looked at all the problems that were being created because of these three factors.
And you also wrote about the sort of hierarchies of hospitals in the book. Is that and the difficulties involved there? Could I ask you about that?
I mean, I think that the culture of medicine is a very toxically hierarchical culture, which is a theme that I have continued looking at in my latest books. And so basically, doctors are trained and socialized to give orders to nurses, not to solicit input from nurses, and to really dismiss nurses, not to really listen to their concerns. And it's a learned behavior, and nurses are taught to be deferential and not to speak up. And the environment of healthcare is very psychologically unsafe for people who speak up, whether it's residents to attendings and med students to residents, or, you know, nurses' aides to nurses or nurses to doctors. And so this issue of hierarchy and hubris and being taught that patient care is all yours, that it's not a collaborative effort, is very problematic and is one of the things that really demoralizes nurses and is responsible for people leaving nursing or people not going into nursing. What's really interesting today is that there was a lot of discussion of the nursing shortage. A lot of stories came out about the importance of nursing. A lot of studies came out documenting the relationship between nurse staffing or the ratio of patients to nurses and patient outcomes and patient deaths. And so there was a big effort to end the shortage and to bring more nurses into the workforce, which did help. But what's happening now is we have a real distressing repeat of precisely the kinds of trends that led to the shortage of the late 90s and early 2000s, where hospitals are not hiring enough at new graduates of nursing schools. They're very worried about the Affordable Care Act. They're very they're into their, you know, financial survival mode. They are really kind of doing what I call get away with what you can nurse to patient ratios, except in California. And so you have, interestingly, a situation which could lead to another nursing shortage, particularly when you consider that the nursing workforce is aging and people are going to retire soon. And if we don't have enough nurses in the pipeline, it's going to be a real problem because we have baby boomers aging and a lot of nurse baby boomers are going to retire.
This is KZYX. Our program this morning is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and this morning I'm talking with Suzanne Gordon, the Bay Area healthcare activist and writer who also writes about nurses. She's just been talking with us about her book, Nursing Against the Odds, just one of many books. Suzanne, following up on that, let me ask you about this. Nurses still tend to be women. This must be a factor. I remember reading an account of a 1970s strike of nurses up in Seattle, and there was a statement from a doctor who said, kind of lamented, there was a time when the doctors could yell at the nurses, he said, if I remember this correctly, he says, but now we can't do that anymore. We have all these smart young nurses, he says, just out of college, and they want to do things their own way. He was referring to the women's movement in a sense, because how could you, can you bring those things into this story?
Well, it's very interesting because the women's movement sort of missed nursing and nursing missed the women's movement. And I think there was a big tendency within the women's movement. And I think, you know, I reflected that because I was I was a big participant in the women's movement. I'm 67, and I actually worked on one of the first feminist journals called Women, a Journal of Liberation, and I think that there was a big focus in the women's movement about getting, because it was a large, it was a very middle and upper middle class movement in some ways, and there was a big focus on liberating women to become doctors and lawyers and stockbrokers and whatever, and there wasn't much focus on getting men into male, into sort of female professions like nursing and kindergarten teaching and so forth. And so I think a lot of early feminists thought, well, if the nurses, you know, if women became doctors, and maybe if we thought about nurses at all, we would have thought if the nurses became doctors, that would be enough. And so you actually had this huge push, which has succeeded, and over 50% of medical school classes are women, and many, many physicians, and not enough maybe surgeons, and there are not enough leading physicians who are women, maybe. But there really was no discussion of enhancing the conditions of caregiving work or nursing work or getting more men into nursing. So, you know, now, I mean, you say doctor to a young person, and a female or a male may pop into their head. You say doctor to somebody my age, and, you know, I'll go to my grave thinking man, right? But you don't, a young person doesn't think, when they say the word nurse, they don't think man or woman, because nursing remains pretty much 90 to 95% female. And I think that's a real failure of feminism, because we didn't pay enough attention to expanding the circle. I mean, there was a big focus on getting guys to help with the housework and child rearing, but as to getting men into nursing, and even elite women now, you know, a lot of them don't want to be a bedside nurse. They want to be a nurse practitioner or a nurse midwife or a, you know, psych nurse practitioner, because that role looks more like the physician, whereas, you know, the tendency of elite women to become a bedside nurse is much less. And for men to go into bedside nursing, I mean, you'll find pockets of men in OR nursing and ER. I just met with a wonderful nurse, Michael Fox, in the Bay Area, who was a labor and delivery nurse. But you don't have a lot of men in nursing, and certainly not as much as there should be. But I think if you look at why are nurses more deferential, I don't think it's because they're women. I think it's because they're being socialized into a model of female deference that women in other professions are not socialized into. I mean, you have 50% of women in medicine, and they're women, but they're being socialized into a, you know, take over, take charge, be a public figure culture. I think nursing is still socializing women into a sort of private culture. You see, for example, there's a big phenomenon now in nursing where they have this thing called the DAISY Awards, where they, and you know, it's called the DAISYFoundation.org, and they use the most typical gendered sugar and spice and everything nice images to reward nurses for their work. And I think these ideas reinforce the notion that women should only be nurses, and that nursing is a kind of sugar and spice and everything nice. You know, it's caring, it's sweet, it's compassion, it's doing these little things, these nice little things. And so that culture persists in nursing, and it's a real problem.
Okay. One of the ways that I guess that you respond to this is by letting nurses talk for themselves. And several of your books involved a lot of that. Is one book is called When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough. Could you say a word about what you're trying to do there?
Yeah. I co-wrote a book with my colleague, who's also a journalist, Bernice Beresh, in 2000, called From Silence to Voice, what nurses know and must communicate to the public. And this book is now coming out in its third edition in May. And both Bernice and I have been trying to get nurses to tell their story, but to tell their story in accurate ways that really accurately captures the complexity of nursing care, which is not just about emotional and psychosocial caring, but about medicine, knowledge of medicine, knowledge of treatments, knowledge of physiology, knowledge of anatomy. And caring in nursing is a cognitive skill. I mean, it's not just oozing empathy. It's knowing when to ask a difficult question, knowing when to hold someone's hands. Not everybody wants to have their hand held. And I think of From Silence to Voice, which is a very how-to book, I think of When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough, stories of nurses standing up for themselves, their patients, and their professions as a kind of, okay, here's what it looks like when you move from silence to voice. And it's 73 stories written by nurses from all over the world that tells what it means to be a nurse and all the knowledge and skill and persistence and grit and courage that you need in order to tell your story and in order to be a nurse and what nursing is all about. And so that book came out, I believe, I think it was in 2010. And it was edited by me, but it was very much a reaction to the Chicken Soup for the Nurse's Soul books, which is really all about sugar and spice and everything nice and praying for the patient and hugging the patient and worrying about the patient, but not really depicting all the kinds of incredible things that nurses know and that nurses do in order to save our lives, really.
And you just said you talk to nurses all over the world. Let me ask you about that. I know you speak a lot. I know you speak literally all over the place, including internationally. I know you're very modest about this, but what are you trying to say to nurses, and why do they want to listen to you? I think you've been to almost every continent. What are people looking for or listening for these days, do you think, nurses?
Well, I think that nurses have been very devalued, and they have gotten a message culturally and also from inside their own culture that they're supposed to shut up, that they can talk about certain things but not about other things. For example, this whole what I call sentimentalized caring narrative in nursing. You know, as a nurse, many of them feel very comfortable talking about you know, it's kind of like the Daisy Awards. You know, I brought a bouquet of flowers to a patient. I organized a wedding for a patient. I brought them a snack mix. I'm really caring. But they get their hands slapped if they talk about their medical knowledge, which they have, and they get their hands slapped often, or they're discouraged if they talk about their technical knowledge. And the point is that nursing is a tapestry, you know, it's not just one thing. And one moment it may be one thing, and another moment it may be another thing. And I think that I'm encouraging nurses to tell their whole story. I mean, increasingly today, I'm encouraging nurses to get teamwork skills, because nurses, for example, think that they're great communicators. They think that the docs are the only ones who can't communicate, or, but they're not very good at conflict resolution and team building and communication, because these are skills that nobody's taught them. If you talk to an aide or an LPN, they'll say about nurses just exactly in the same words what nurses say about doctors. And it's just really disturbing from the point of view of patient safety, which I really am a patient advocate. You know, I'm a patient safety advocate. I'm not a nurse. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a pharmacist. I view myself as being a PP or an SP, which is a potential patient or a sometime patient. And I have been on the receiving end of excellent nursing care and some pretty scary nursing care. And I've been on the receiving end of very good nurse-doctor relationships and very poor nurse-doctor relationships. And it's not just the fault of the doctor if there's a poor nurse-physician relationship, or, you know, or you you may depend on a nursing assistant for your care. And so whether there's teamwork between the nursing assistant and the nurse is really important as well. And so increasingly I'm focusing on teamwork and communication in everybody, not just the nurse, because nurses can make things better and be part of the solution, or they can make things worse because they haven't gotten team-building skills, they haven't gotten negotiation skills, they haven't gotten conflict resolution skills in their education, just like doctors don't get it and pharmacists.
Okay, so we'll come back to that in just a minute, but would you comment for us on sort of any perspective you have on the international scene? Are things better in some places than others, or nurses
I think
different?
That it's very interesting that from the point of view of patient safety and the valuing of nursing, I mean, nurses have very similar problems wherever they are. I think the strongest nursing are in the Scandinavian countries, where they have these very powerful nurses unions. We have some strong unions, like in California, the California Nurses Association, Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Nurses Association. But there's very serious problems with the way cultures view the role of the nurse as a sort of physician extender. And so I think that internationally, I mean, it really sort of depends on what you're looking at. I mean, internationally, from the point of view of how their work is organized, patient safety is probably enhanced by the fact that in Europe and the UK and Australia and New Zealand, nurses and physicians' hours are regulated, and nurses are not, they can't work 12-hour plus shifts like they work in the U.S., and so that's much better for patient outcomes. In a lot of states in Australia, there's efforts to have nurse-to-patient ratios, which this was led by the Victorian Nurses Federation, which has the only mandated nurse-to-patient ratios in the world aside from in California. So it kind of depends on what aspect of nursing and patient safety you're looking at when you make these international comparisons.
Okay, and you mentioned ratios, just to fill that in before we move ahead. And in California, we have ratios?
Yes, we're very lucky. For 10 years, the California Nurses Association fought very long and hard for safe nurse-to-patient ratios. And after a 10-year campaign, they won them in 2000, I believe it was. And I think they were implemented in 2003. I can't remember the exact dates, and we have, luckily, patients in California have nurse-to-patient ratios of varying numbers so that you can't, no nurse can have more than a certain number of patients. I believe it's 1 to 5 on med-surg, and so medical-surgical floors, which are the majority, and 1 to 4 on specialty floors like oncology or whatever. But that's very rare. And in Australia, they have nurse-to-patient ratios, but that's really rare. And it's really critical to patient safety because, you know, patients are so sick in hospitals today. They're in for very short lengths of stay. That means they're much more acutely ill when they're in the hospital. And if you don't have ratios, I don't really see how you can talk about patient safety, because if a nurse is taking care of 6 patients or 7 patients, or at night 8 patients or 16 patients, there is just no way that nurse can keep patients safe. And physicians also are carrying way too many patient loads. I mean, When I was in healthcare, the average primary care physician had a patient panel. That's all their patients, some of whom they see and some of whom they don't, of something like 800 patients. Now it's up to like 3,000. Now you have these 10-minute, 8-minute visits. Well, you can't deal with all the problems of chronic illnesses and aging and so forth in 8 to 10 minutes. And people are like completely burned out. And so everybody is becoming way too overloaded, way too fatigued to keep people safe and to function adequately in teams.
This is KZYX, our program, talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. Our guest today is the writer Suzanne Gordon. We've been talking about her work and her books. We're going to turn to her latest book. I think it's her latest. She writes very quickly. Her latest book, Beyond the Checklist. We started a discussion of this. Beyond the Checklist, What Else the Healthcare Industry Can Learn from Aviation Safety and Teamwork. So we're sort of leaving the hospital a bit. What's
Oh, no, we're not leaving the hospital.
Okay. We're headed toward the airport, no?
We're headed towards the airport and going back to the hospital after we get on the plane and off.
Okay, so what's going on here?
Well, if you look at issues of patient safety and teamwork, so I was really interested from the minute I walked into hospitals in the late 80s, I was really interested in this sort of sorry state of nurse, doctor, 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 nurse, nurse, you know, everybody's interrelationships and teamwork. Everybody talks about teamwork. Everybody is on a team. Everybody talks about the healthcare team. But in reality, there really is very often no they're there. I call them intimate strangers involved in parallel play at the bedside. And so when I was thinking about patient safety and thinking about teamwork and the way people treated each other and didn't work together in hospitals, I kept running across these initials, CRM, which stands for Crew Resource Management, and it's the aviation safety model, and everybody was talking about it, and I read some articles about it. And I don't know, about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, I was somewhere on vacation in the summer, and I thought, you know, I'm a journalist. I get to call people up cold and ask them questions. I'm just going to start calling people up who are involved in the patient safety in the aviation safety movement, and just ask them about CRM. And I started, and one thing led to another, and I pretty much interviewed, like, a lot of the people that were involved in this. A guy called Robert Helmreich, who's an organizational psychologist, who really is kind of the granddaddy of CRM, and Clay Fouché, who's, I believe, now at the FAA, and Robert Francis, who was at the FAA Federal Aviation Administration and then has just retired as vice chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. And I started asking them about CRM and, you know, does this really work? A conversation I had with Bob Francis, who I said, you know, okay, so Bob, tell me, does this real? You know, is this real? Is this just PR? And he said, okay, Suzanne, here's the thing. In aviation, before CRM, the situation was the captain is in the cockpit. The first officer or flight engineer gets in, and the captain conveys one way or another, whether it's implicitly or explicitly, I'm the captain, I'm king, don't see anything, don't touch anything, don't say anything, don't do anything, don't touch anything, don't say anything, shut up. And he said, now it's I'm the captain, I'm king, please tell me if you see me making a mistake. And I was just so stunned by that comment that I said, I have to write about this. I have to write a book about this. And I was in conversations with my colleague, Bonnie O'Connor, who's a medical educator, and we started, you know, working on this. And I just started interviewing people, and I went to Airbus and spent a week there looking at their simulations and their training. And I talked to captains, and I talked to people at JetBlue, and I talked to people here and there. And I finally met Patrick Mendenhall, who is an international commercial airlines pilot who teaches CRM, and we invited him to join our little team, and we wrote this book together. And I think it's the first book that really shows what exactly they learn as pilots and flight attendants and ground crews and so forth to make what they've learned over the years to make aviation safer. And aviation, taking a commercial airliner, is now safer than it's ever been. And that was, I think, shown very dramatically in 2009 with the flight, U.S. Airways flight 1549, piloted, captained by Chesley Sullenberger, Sully, who actually did the foreword for our book. And that was not divine intervention that made that flight come out okay. It was, or the skill of one guy, even though he's amazingly skilled, it was a crew resource management triumph. It was the flight attendants, it was the help from the passengers, it was the first responders, the people on the Coast Guard, the ferry, people who also practiced.
Suzanne, we might not all recall that.
Basically what happened is January 9th, 2009. They're on the fifth leg of a five-day trip, which means they've had a number of flights, four flights before. They take off from LaGuardia. They get hit by a flock of Canada geese. Their engines are kaput, and he has 3 minutes and 28 seconds, and he's flying over the Hudson, and he lands the plane on the Hudson, and all these passengers get out on the wings because of the work of the flight attendants. And, you know, it's frigid, it's freezing, and the Coast Guard, the ferries that take people across the Hudson from Manhattan, you know, basically zoom into action, and basically no one was hurt, and everybody got off that plane. And we have a little video on our website, www.beyondthechecklist.com, where we talk about CRM, and you can see some footage of that. And Sully has really said, you know, this was a joint action. It was me, my co-pilot, you know, these three flight attendants, the passengers, the first responders, and that's how come it worked. But the thing that, you know, a lot of people don't know is that Sully helped. He was a CRM trainer. I mean, he helped design the CRM training at U.S. Airways, and he teaches it or taught it. All these flight attendants had been involved in CRM training every year of their careers. The pilots learn it twice, are revisited twice a year annually. The flight attendants once a year. They sometimes train together, sometimes not. And these people never met each other before this trip. They'd never met each other. If this hadn't happened, they might not have ever met each other again. But they learn what I call team intelligence in their training and in their recurrent training. They learn how to work on a team, how to share information, how to go, you know, how to become hyper-organized in a crisis. That's very different from what aviation used to be like, and it's very different from what healthcare is now.
So take us there to the hospital then.
Well, I mean, you have in the hospital, as I said, a bunch of solo practitioners engaged in this kind of parallel play at the bedside. People don't brief each other. People don't learn together. It's beginning to change, and we have some examples in the book, Beyond the Checklist, of three case studies where it is changing and has changed. And there is a big push that we hope to help move forward with this book in interprofessional education and interprofessional care and practice. But I think the norm is that, you know, the doctor comes in. If we just look at the hospital, the doctor comes in the patient's room and, you know, does his thing, doesn't brief the nurse who's coming in when he leaves. The nurse doesn't ask for a briefing. The nurse has to find out from the patient what's going on. the doctor goes on to the next patient, or this could be a doc, could be a resident. There's no briefings during the day. There's no information sharing. People are allowed to blow each other off. There's no soliciting input from the nurse, from the aide, from the housekeeper. The resident is scared to admit mistakes to the attending. The people are very uncivil to each other. They are afraid to admit that they made mistakes because, and it's not just because they're going to face malpractice. It's because it's a, you know, they're going to be ridiculed when if a resident says, I don't know how to do something, I'm in over my own head, I need help, or if a resident call, you know, if a resident, if a nurse says to a resident, we need the attending, and the resident calls the attending, they get a bad mark because they're supposed to solve it themselves. It's not a culture where people are comfortable asking for help. Aviation was like that 40 years ago. Now, if a pilot gets, if a captain gets into trouble, like on the Qantas flight recently, they'll call back and they'll see if there's other pilots on the flight, deadheading, you know, sort of hitching a ride, and five of them will be invited up into the cockpit to help figure this out. Doctors and nurses who have family members in the hospital or friends will tell you they're terrified. They have a big kind of conversation with themselves. Should I speak up? Because they'll be blown off by other doctors and nurses who think, oh, that's that uppity doc from someplace who's trying to take over. I mean, it's really interesting. That's a model that can change. It has changed in aviation, and it can change in healthcare.
Okay. Very interesting. So to find out more about this, it's the book is called Beyond the Checklist, right? It's published last fall.
No, it was just published in December by the Culture and Politics of Healthcare Work series at Cornell University Press. And
that's
if
Lynn
you
Winter.
Want to see this video that we made, which we really like, it's on www.beyondthechecklist.com. And I just want to give a plug to Peter Coyote, who is another California famous person, who is an actor who was so interested in this that he did the voiceover for free because he really felt that this makes an important difference to people to know about this kind of thing. And so Peter's voice is on the video, and you may recognize it if you listened or watched the video.
And you watch it where?
It's on our website, www.beyondthechecklist.com, or you can go to YouTube directly and just put in Beyond the Checklist and scroll down, and it'll be there.
Suzanne, let me ask you a general question. Maybe we'll get toward concluding with this. I'm not asking you to go through the ins and outs and ups and downs of Obamacare and the healthcare crisis we hear so much about, and the cost of medical care, all of that. But maybe you could make a comment just from your own point of view about what you think of this crisis that we hear so much about, and also about these proposals to get people to help themselves, to make themselves well, sometimes called wellness programs. How would you connect these to your work on healthcare safety, nurses, prevention, and so forth? Can you do that for us?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's a huge move now to sort of outsource being healthy or keeping healthy on to patients or to regular people, and it takes various forms. I mean, it's about, you know, patients being more engaged in their care and, you know, everything from asking your provider if they wash their hands to, you know, knowing what medications you're on to having these corporate wellness programs that are all over the place where you are actually penalized if you're obese or you didn't stop smoking or you didn't do this or that. And, I mean, I think that, yes, of course people should stay well. They shouldn't smoke. They shouldn't drink. They shouldn't eat too much. They should take part in decision-making. But the system is responsible for that, not the individual patient. I mean, if you look at, just look at obesity. I mean, you know, how can you penalize a person for being obese when they're having ads on children's programs about, you know, for sugary snacks, when you have the Cheesecake Factory, which stunningly and shockingly, the medical writer Atul Gawande has promoted as a model for healthcare. I mean, you have the food industry manipulating the content of sugar, fat, and salt in food to make people addicted to food. I mean, you can't lay that on the poor person who has bought into that. You can't, you know, I mean, vegetables are more expensive than crummy food in this country because of our agricultural policies. And even air conditioning affects how much you weigh. So, I mean, there is this attempt to kind of outsource the problem of health care costs onto patients and sick people and to not look at the policies that really create a lot of our health problems. I mean, you know, Medicare, for example, or health insurance will only pay a part if you're obese or you have diabetes and you need 10 sessions of nutritional counseling, insurance won't pay for the whole cost of that visit, yet they'll pay for you to get your leg amputated. So there's all kinds of things that need to be changed on a system level, which doesn't mean that people should, you know, buy 12 cartons of cigarettes and huge sugary drinks. I mean, they should take responsibility for their health, yes. But I think we have to look at structural issues as opposed to simply individualizing the problem and stigmatizing the poor sick person or vulnerable person or poor person, which is a lot easier to do because it's a lot easier to stigmatize that person than, you know, to pass a ban on sugary, a tax on sugary drinks like we tried to do in Richmond, California. So it's simplifying very complex structural problems, and I think we will never solve our healthcare crisis if we don't do that, if we stop simplifying and individualizing these structural system-wide problems.
Okay, we've got about a minute left. Tell the listeners what you're working on now. What kind of
I've co-written a play with playwright Lisa Hayes called Bedside Manners, and we have a workbook which is associated with the play, which I co-wrote the workbook with Scott Reeves, who's the founding director of the Center for Innovation and Interprofessional Education at UCSF, and that's coming out next year. And I'm working on a book on team stories and how to make teamwork a reality. And then I work with my colleagues from Beyond the Checklist on, you know, training people to really function on teams and resolve conflicts and so forth. So I continue in that line.
Right. Well, Suzanne, we're out of time. Really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk with us this morning. Very interesting, very great work, it seems, that you're doing. So let me thank you again and remind listeners that we've been talking to Suzanne Gordon, and they can find out more at www.suzannegordon.com, the author of many books. The program this morning has been Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and we'll be back again next week. Thanks again.